We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Marth Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Well, this morning we'll be talking with a man who is well-known, certainly as one of America's best-known theologians and religious historians. His name is Martin Marty. He's an emeritus professor of the history of modern Christianity at University of Chicago Divinity School and has written many books on a wide range of religious subjects. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana and will be giving a talk tonight. This is the 2009 Wesley Fall Seminar. Now, Dr. Marty was coming down here this morning by train, and the train was delayed, but we're told that he is on the way. So we'll just tap dance for a while, and when he is here, we'll bring him in, and we'll be very happy to talk with him. I do want to mention, and I'm sure that the folks at Wesley would like me to mention, that this program, their fall seminar, which is taking place at the Wesley Church and Student Foundation Sanctuary on the U of I campus, that's at the corner of Green and Goodwin, is opened to the public, and anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. There also will be a reception given by the Wesley United Methodist Women for Dr. Marty after the lecture in Watsika Lounge at Wesley, and folks are welcome to that as well. So he'll be giving a talk on the subject Religion, Violence, and the Global Searches for Peace tonight at 7 o'clock at the Wesley Church and Student Foundation. And so, and again, anybody who is here in and around Champaign-Urbana who would be interested in hearing Dr. Marty speak, you should certainly feel free to stop by. Maybe what we'll do is we'll just play a little music for you so we can fill some time, and we hope that within the next few minutes we'll be talking with Martin Marty, so don't go away. Thank you. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're also very pleased to have here in the studio with us Martin Marty. He is someone who is quite well known for writing about religion in America, world religion, in fact. He has written over 50 books on a range of religious subjects. He is Fairfax Cone Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of the History of Modern Christianity in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. He's visiting here in Champaign-Urbana and will be giving a talk tonight. This is the 2009 Wesley Fall Seminar at the Wesley Church and Student Foundation Sanctuary on the U of I campus. That's at the corner of Green and Goodwin. He'll be speaking on the topic Religion, Violence, and the Global Searches for Peace. There will also be a reception afterwards given by the Wesley United Methodist Women, and both the lecture and the reception are open to the public and free, and anyone who is in Champaign-Urbana would like to hear Dr. Marty, you should feel welcome to stop by. And we're also inviting here questions. We will be talking a little bit about religion in America and the world, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Questions are welcome. We ask people to try to be brief, but questions are welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here.
I appreciate you being here. I thought that I would ask you a little bit to react to some religion in the news, and perhaps you have read about this. Recently, a survey has come out, a preliminary results of a survey that has come out from the Hartford Institute for Religious Research, looking at church life in America. And no doubt there will be more in greater detail. But their initial numbers that they have put out suggest that there are perhaps some challenges for churches and religious people in the country. And they think that there is, in fact, what they call here a clear, consistent, short-term direction that is negative, including worship attendance, spiritual vitality, sense of mission and purpose. And they think that actually this is not something that's recent, that this maybe goes back at least to the year 2000, and that it extends across all a number of different kinds of congregations. That is, old-line Protestants, yes, but also evangelicals and Catholics and Orthodox, and that it's an across-the-board kind of thing. Now, I suppose one can look at the numbers and ask, well, just how important is that? But there is a trend, and so I wonder what you think about that.
Okay. You're right in the way you phrased it. We're all taught to be somewhat suspicious of polls, depending on how you phrase it. But you're also, I think, right in the assessment that overall there is a downtrend in most of these indicators. Probably least downtrend in the second of the things you mentioned, religious vitality. That is, a lot of people are in very informal definitions of religious, without being part of religious institutions. And so I think, having spent 6 weeks in three different cities in Europe in the last year, where church attendance is extremely low, that what's going on in America is not so much, quote, a rebellion against God. Formal atheism doesn't go very far. The best-selling books of 3-4 people are counterindicators. Mm-hmm. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on that. And from Tom Paine and Ethan Allen down to our time, there are always some such. But it changed habits of life. I remember writing 40, 50 years ago, the biggest threats to the way religion is practiced in America was the high-rise and the long weekend, the high-rise apartment. I lived for 43 years in a leafy suburb where, oh, I suppose 30% of the people were at worship every week in Catholic, mainline, evangelical, the whole range. I now live on the 85th floor of the John Hancock Center, and I can look out on hundreds of thousands of people. And I think if you were at the parking gates for people driving away and try to assess what percent is heading for synagogue or church, it would be very low. And I watched the marathon looking down. I see marathons coming by on Sunday morning and seeing that if they were in a suburb and had two little kids the way their parents had, they'd likely be in worship. So I think we adjust our way of life, and religion sort of lags with that.
Yeah. Do surveys continue to find if people are simply asked a very open-ended question like, do you believe in God? Do we still get large numbers of people saying yes?
Oh, yes. I think you're going to run 80 to 90% will say somehow they believe in God. The more you begin to define it, the more narrow it gets. Do you believe in a personal God who can be addressed and who can intervene in human affairs? It's going to drop down some. But in a way, it's astonishing to see how high these numbers are. Over 70% of the American people believe there is a heaven, and about 60% believe there is a hell. In other words, over half the people are in that. Some of the surprising ones are, if you ask the science and creationism question, most Christians who aren't fundamentalist don't have much trouble with evolution. And yet, if you pose it in the question form, do you believe in creationism or evolution, a clear majority of the people do that, without buying into all of the things that creationists believe, but that somehow all we see, all that we are, is a subject of a creator God.
Hmm. So I wonder why you think it is that people, if they say that they believe in God and they believe in ideas like heaven and hell, and perhaps then that means they believe that somehow, in some fashion, they're going to be called to account at some time for how they've lived their life, you know. Why is it that they don't feel the need of any kind of established place to go, to engage in some kind of worship and to, you know, have fellowship with other people who believe as they do?
Well, the negative side of what you're asking is not a big threat, fear of judgment. It's really amazing how little of that is there. As long ago as 1952, the first survey of this sort taken of American religion asked, do you believe that there is a hell? And it was up in the upper 80s. Do you believe that it is in any way a threat to you? Among the people who believe there was such, 1 out of 12. That's 50-some years ago, 60 years ago, and it certainly hasn't gone up. I did a lecture at Harvard some years ago called Hell Disappeared and No One Noticed. If you read 19th century McGuffey readers that are used in every public school, the teacher tells the child that you better behave. Don't tell a lie. If you tell a lie and you're not forgiven, you will be sent to hell. And you'll never see your parents again. And the kid asks, well, the parents will be in heaven, and they'll enjoy looking down on you because you violated what God wanted. That's hardly what you're going to get in schools today. And nobody noticed. I think in Catholicism, I grew up in a half-Catholic community, and on Friday, school picnic, if a kid bit into a ham sandwich and didn't know it, she ran off to the priest because she might be hit by a car later that day and she could go to hell. That's just not even on the screen. So that half, I think, takes care of itself. Comparing it, let's say, to the Middle Ages, Christendom, if you see the cathedrals and the gargoyles and the statues, you could see that there's a real sense that an unforgiven sin would condemn you. The other side, though, I think, is it. Why is there not as much coalition to achieve the things that people go to churches for? And there, I think, here again, it's a big cultural thing. For one thing, a lot of people are just living for themselves, and if they can arrange it with God that there are no atheists in foxholes, okay. The large majority, I think, do have some sense. I think every survey shows this, that if you are, I hope, a human, a citizen, but especially if you are a believer or a Christian, you belong to a social order, a civil society, and it should be part of your burden and joy to take part in it. Now, some of that can be drained off in that there are many fine secular agencies that can do this, or semi-religious, or whatever, not organized by the church. Think of the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts and the countless organizations like this where you get heavy doses of teamwork and morality and so on. Whereas church, it's a little more exacting. You make a commitment, you really ought to be there every time they gather, et cetera, and not everybody's ready for that.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Martin Marty. He is Professor Emeritus of History of Modern Christianity in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago and has been thinking about and talking about and writing about religion Christianity specifically in America and also around the world. He's been doing that for a very long time. He's here visiting on the campus. We'll be giving a talk tonight. This is the 2009 Wesley Fall Seminar, Religion, Violence, and the Global Searches for Peace. It takes place at the Wesley Church and Student Foundation Sanctuary on the U of I campus. That's at the corner of Green and Goodwin. And if you'd like to attend, hear what he has to say, you're welcome. Questions here are welcome, too. 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller to bring in here, someone in Bloomington. So we'll go right there on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I was just discussing a topic in regards to religion as far as different churches where I have a friend of mine who was basically the church, it's a Baptist church, adopted a family from in Africa or Burundi, and then I have another church where they've adopted other families from Iraq and Iran. And what I don't understand is what happened to take care of our own kind. I don't understand. It's like I know in my church we have a lot of people that have financial difficulties, and some of them are even homeless. But for some reason, we're giving money and we're setting people up that don't even belong in this country. Well, I shouldn't say not belong, but that are not Native Americans. And it seems to be coming from the Catholics, the Baptists, the Presbyterians. I just don't understand it. And especially with the economy being the way it is, why is that? And you know, and for me to believe in God, taking care of things, the way things are going now, I almost think we're living in hell.
Okay, well, I'll pick up on one of your phrases. If you are a Native American, your ancestors had to be here 30,000 years ago. I'm not a Native American. Mine came from Switzerland in 1869, the same way people come today. And everybody's from somewhere. So I think the idea of the native, it is true, inevitably true, that one does tend to take care more of one's own, but the issue is how you become one's own. There are no boundaries, really. If you are a believer in God, there are no boundaries here as to where love should stop or justice should stop, whether it's the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, whether it's Jesus, consistently, you don't ask any other questions. If the child needs a cup of cold water, you hand them the cold water. Inevitably, there have to be priorities. You can't just lower every barrier and have everybody in the world come to the safest and best places, but you can't put a boundary here. And I think one of the things that we've perceived is that we live in a very luxurious place, and then you are aware of what happens in Sudan, Somalia, Tanzania, etc. See the swollen bellies of little children and so on. And you can do something about it. You do. We have friends who are optometrists in the Chicago area, husband-wife team and son and daughter team, who give 1 month every year. And they'll only go to the worst places, Rwanda and Khartoum last year and so on. They wouldn't have to do that. They could sit right at home and be making more money, which they don't really need. But they just have a love for people and have the thrill of seeing that somebody who couldn't see can now see. So I don't see how we can set up boundaries, even if we have to have some priorities.
And I'm sure that there are many, many church people who are doing outreach in their own communities. Certainly there are in Champaign-Urbana.
Well, I always say that if you would look at the church bulletins that you get on a Sunday morning at the churches, mainline and Catholic and evangelical and African-American and so on, and add up just the numbers of things there that are there from transporting people, meals on wheels, cancer bandage wrapping, care for kids and so on. It's huge. I once was co-advisor to a dissertation at the University of Chicago in the School of Social Work Administration. And the student made a study of, she called it Lake City. It was no secret. It was Evanston, Illinois, a largest suburb. Highly educated place. Northwestern University is there. Mainly well-off people, but it has its slums too, et cetera. And they made a study and found that the main agencies for care of the aged were the churches, because the people go to the churches and they get support. Many of these churches, for what kind of thing would never show up in a survey, somebody has a stroke. and lies there for a day and a half. Never again, because from then on they work out a network in which every morning you phone the next person in the line. They found that it's just an enormous thing, and the social workers who are doing wonderful work just couldn't possibly be doing all this through volunteer but still paid agencies. So, yes, this is going on. Several years ago, a sociologist at Princeton, Robert Wuthnow, made a study, and to his surprise, 56% of all adult Americans are in regular volunteer work, not just giving, mm-hmm. but doing it, and moved on and found that 60% of them do it through religious institutions, and 70% do it with their main motivation being religious. So he asked, how do they do it? Well, you can't coerce it, then it's not volunteer. You can't browbeat people, you know, you got to do it. You tell stories, and you become part of stories. Could be the biblical stories, Good Samaritan stories. Could be stories like the one I told you about this Christian doctor and his wife who go to Khartoum out of love for Christ. It could be all those grounds. But we are people moved by stories. And I think one of the dangers we have in your first question, when people desert these agencies because of their flaws, and there are many, what takes their place? And not much does. Mm-hmm. You don't find... unless you're bound up with a religious or other agency, you don't do much. Mm-hmm. You'll see a wonderful story in a morning newspaper of some little child who needs help, and the next day there'll be $8,400 given or so on, which lasts 2-3 days, and then the story disappears. Whereas if they become vivid to a body of 200 people or 2,000 people, there's sustained character.
Yeah. You know, I started out by asking you a little bit about this recent study from the Hartford Institute that shows perhaps some decline in the health of Christianity here, of Christian churches. Maybe mm-hmm. we shouldn't just say Christianity, but Christian churches in the United States. And I think, though, you have to say, if you look around the world, that there are certainly places where Christianity is thriving, particularly in the developing world.
Excuse me.
To the extent, mm-hmm. and the thing that's interesting about it is that when those people accept Christianity, they bring to it their own worldview and the things that they think are important. And I think that some people would argue that now we shouldn't be talking about Christianity. We should be talking about Christianities.
You're right.
And I'm wondering what you think about it, and in particular whether... maybe the attitudes and the priorities and the worldviews of, say Christians in Africa, and there's been a terrific growth in Protestant Christianity in Africa, whether that ends up feeding back to Christianity as a whole. I mean, what does it mean for the bigger, if we make it make the community as big as possible when we're talking about that, what does it mean for the bigger community as a whole?
Okay, we'll take the two parts of it. First of all, you're right about the growth. Christianity is becoming the faith of the non-Muslim half of the poor world. Christianity and Muslim are growing at the same pace, 1.25% per year around the world. And Christianity is holding its own one-third. We're talking nominal people on the list. But the surge is in the poor world. I was in three different places last year in Europe, Prague for 2 weeks, Helsinki for 2 weeks, and Paris for 2 weeks. In Prague, everyone says we're the most secular country on earth. That's a long tradition. Of all the immigrants to America, and no group had more anti-clericals, anti-religious than the Czechs. I've grown up in Czech communities, and I know them well. They were beat up by the emperor, beat up by the pope, beat up by everybody else, and they just chucked it. Those who stayed didn't stay very religious. Got a couple of nice cathedrals, but otherwise that's it. Helsinki, I'm Lutheran, so I have to take some burden for this, is 98%, Finland is 98% Lutheran and 2% church attendance. Paris is probably 90% still. There's a large Muslim population now, but probably 90% listed as Catholic. And yet the cathedrals are empty. In Tanzania, you just announced that somebody's traveling through and they'll have services tomorrow, and you have 3,000 people there. So, yes, there's a very different kind of pattern. The northern world loses 3,000 nominal Christians per day. the southern world, southern Africa, gains 18,000 per day in spite of AIDS, diseases, malaria, war. So that's a surge. Now, the other part of your question, does any of that bounce back up? In many ways, it does. And probably in ways we don't even realize. The worship service books, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, Anglican, and so on, begin to show this. And if you're dealing with youth in the church, they're really up on that. They really many forms of our popular music. When I came on, you had some wonderful jazz on. Well, there are analogs to that in gospel. This was not a direct import from Africa, but it's fed by the African style. In the way you organize the faith, in South Africa one year I spoke to the African Independent Church, AIC, which at that time had 6,000 denominations, because every little prophetic movement is there. And I said, oh, it's sure good to be visiting the African Independent Churches. They said, same initials, but we're not that. What are we independent of? We are now called the African Indigenous Churches, stressing their own growth. They have tremendous impact in Catholicism. One of the next couple popes is certainly going to be, if not Latin American, then African. Maybe near miss this time was. The large federations, Reformed and Lutheran and Anglican, hugely so. And they have an impact. A good illustration of culture clash is the Anglican Church, because the Episcopal Church USA now ordains gays and has bishops. They are, among the denominations, one of the most concerned about the whole world and about African Anglicanism. But in African Anglicanism, you don't allow this. A high official of the Anglican Church one time was pointing out the cultural differences, and he said, I dream of a time when there's a headline that says, the Anglican Church in Africa accepts the American Episcopal Church with its homosexuals, in return for which the American Episcopal Church will accept the Anglican Church in Africa with its polygamy, because there are hundreds of thousands, and it would be very inhumane to throw them out tomorrow. They're structured into family life. Well, that sort of shocks us, and yet it's a presence you deal with. And any world, well, Archbishop Rowan Williams, head of the Anglican Communion, which is a very loose-hung communion, is extremely aware of the moves you make as how they're impacted there. And the Episcopalians here who are leaving the Episcopal Church because of this one thing, hook up with bishops from Africa. So to me, that's a negative example. I'd rather the positive side, but it does illustrate we're all in a tiny globe today.
Yeah. Just, you know, to come back, I forgive me for continuing to come back to the survey, but there was one other thing that I thought was interesting that they pointed to as being a positive and as something that really attracted people, and that was changing style of worship. For congregations that are vital, that's one of the things that apparently was very important. At the same time, I find myself wondering, well, what exactly does that mean, changing style of worship? Does that mean more informal, perhaps, or more different kinds of music, or what exactly does that mean?
Good. Well, there are counter trends to that, or rather smuggled into it. There are counter trends in that the many evangelicals now are joining the Orthodox Church, learning Greek and Russian in order to worship because they wanted more formality than they were getting with the guitars and the drums. Mm-hmm. We're not talking millions. We're talking significant leadership, though. So in every religious body, there is that force that appeals to that in us which seeks continuity. In my own personal life, they could have frozen things after Bach died and I could be happy forever, but I shouldn't be because it's a very different world. I've served churches in inner city where, and come to know those that have people of Latino heritage, and they don't know a mighty fortress is our God, but they have things to teach us, etc. I would say the trend that you're probably alluding to is strangely more evangelical than others who were supposed to be anti-worldly are most at home with pop culture. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, rock music, for example, was the devil's beat. And anybody listening today who's over 50 will remember, if they were evangelical, when their pastor would say Elvis was sinful because he swung his hips and so on. Well, I've covered evangelical youth cultures, Christian bands, same costume, same garb. I can't hear the words in either case. The only difference is they're not smoking pot. And there they are, and they're glad. I talked to one woman, and I said, this is really funny to me how you can make that shift. She said, would you like to hear what the kids would be hearing if they didn't have this alternative? She played some of this obscene rap and hip-hop. And, oh, you could play all you want of that. So it's an adjustment. I don't think we're ever going to be in a stage again where there's going to be a single pattern or norm. Mm-hmm. We're too diverse. You can tell how old somebody is by whether they like rap or hip-hop or who their heroes are. And you carry that in. The Lutherans recently had 37,000 kids at a convention in New Orleans, and most of them know classic hymns, but all the music that week is high decibel, constant throb, etc. And who's going to chase them away? They worship, they teach, they spend 2 days helping rebuild New Orleans, doing what Christ told them to do. So we have to be more diverse. I myself, I have a friend who's a classical musician who said, Marty, if we've got to go to heaven with that music, we're not going. but we're going.
You know, it seems that if we go back, well, now maybe it might be a couple of decades, maybe to the 1980s, it seemed that the big news, one of the things that people talked a lot about was the decline in the old line, the mainline Protestant denominations, and the rather spectacular growth in what one might call fundamentalist or evangelical Pentecostal Protestant denominations, and that that perhaps went hand in hand. The reason maybe people were paying attention to that is because also that was at the point where they began to be, as churches and as congregations, very politically active. Now it seems that along with the kind of decline that we've been talking about, that's across the board. It even affects those kinds of congregations. Has the growth that we've seen in those denominations, has that slowed?
There is a slowing of growth, yes. The Southern Baptist Convention now chronicles each year a decline in new membership and a decline in baptisms. That's the biggest of all of them, and that's the best indicator. And they're really quite concerned about where they'll be in 2025 if things don't change. They're the biggest. Many smaller evangelicals are the same. Not enough to have crisis, I don't think, but an indicator. In part, I think they were bought into parts of the culture that themselves are fading. Moving on, if I were buying stock, I wouldn't buy it in fundamentalism. I would buy it in evangelical or Pentecostalism. The mainline churches still decline some, and I think their decline was rooted in they were so glued to a particular culture as late as the 1950s. If your parents were Methodists, you were brought up in Methodist youth and you became a Methodist, United Methodist. Now you go to the University of Illinois and you meet a Sikh or a Muslim or a whatever, and you marry and you make different kinds of decisions. Odds are very strong that a couple of years later, if you have children, you are going to affiliate somewhere. But the key word now is choice. It's very different. And I think that the churches called Old Line were very good at serving as kind of chaplains to the old establishment. Every new Episcopal bishop would be written up in Newsweek magazine. Today you've got to have a big scandal to be written up in Newsweek magazine. The other part of your question, though, or let me say this, the established churches coasted. Somebody made a survey, like your Hartford people once, asking Episcopalians, when did you last invite somebody to church? And they ran it out longitudinally, and it's put it kind of waggishly, the average Episcopalian invites somebody to church every 28 years. Well, I can't get through O'Hare Field without being invited by three evangelicals to come to some Nazarene church. They knew there wouldn't be a church if they didn't do it. The political side of it is not going to die out, but it's confused. For one thing, I deal a lot with evangelicals who are in sadness, almost a tragic sadness. Almost every big political scandal in recent years has been an elected evangelical, family, pro-family. You could just the list. And of course, the media like them and they blow that up. But you talk to concerned evangelicals, and they are very concerned. In other words, they're learning that something didn't go right with that parading of piety, and there's a little retreat there. I think a lot of excitement in evangelicalism. When I go to campuses and talk on a forum on the environment, you're going to count on evangelicals being leaders in that. 20 years ago, they said it was pagan. It was harmonic convergence and mystical and so on. They read their Bibles again, and they're coming to it. So I don't think anybody's going to write them off, but they are changing their patterns rather significantly.
Yeah. That's interesting. It seems that, again, across the board, if you look at the makeup of congregations and you look at within particular congregations and look at the percentage of people that are, say, over 50 and under 50, that the spread is really increasing. And apparently it's among the old line Protestant denominations, the spread is the widest. They have the most over 50s. But it's true all the way across the board that it seems that they're having difficulty attracting younger people.
Well, the culture changed very suddenly, and almost nobody caught on to it. Look at priests are now averaging out to age 70, and nuns, if they're around at all, sisters, are up there. Protestant churches, which have ordained women as pastors, are attracting many more young people to the clergy, and some men too. Every year the age goes down, but you're not asking so much about clergy as about the overall trend. There, again, the cultural shift was so sudden. Some people are successful. I think you have all the way back to early Billy Graham and Youth for Christ, and such agencies have been very good at attracting the young. And significant minorities of all the groups do. But I don't think they stayed ahead of the new language. I'm not saying that they could have adapted to everything that suddenness of change. But if you want to talk about one key word between 40 years ago and now, the key word is choice. Peter Berger, a great sociologist, wrote a book called The Heretical Imperative. The Greek word heresis means choice. And you used to get a kick out of the church for heresy. It meant you made a choice than the other. Mm-hmm. But now he says you're all choice. You moved to a new community. My wife and I kid about it. We're Lutheran to the core. But when choosing churches, we kid about it. We went to one because we like the music, and they had the best chocolate donuts. Well, we didn't really mean that, but it was part of the overall picture. You're doing all that. Mm-hmm. And almost everybody I know who stays within a tradition is still doing some selecting within it.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Martin Marty. He is the Fairfax Cone Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of the History of Modern Christianity in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, where he taught for quite a long time, 35 years. He's the author of over 50 books on a wide range of religious subjects and is called upon often to comment on religion in America. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. We'll give a talk tonight. This is the 2009 Wesley Fall Seminar at 7 o'clock. He'll be speaking on religion, violence, and the global searches for peace at the Wesley Church and Student Foundation on the U of I campus. And it's open to anybody who would like to attend. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, and people who are listening are also welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Mm-hmm. Why is God referred to as He?
That was a very succinct question. I like you.
Would all our callers were? What
no,
did
that
all?
Was, so that was fun. Why is God referred to as He? I think in there are goddesses in some of the religions. They haven't made it in Christianity. Mary is very clearly not God, and yet she is. In official theology, the bearer of God, so she plays very close to it there. I think the changes coming about now in most Bible translations are just trying to be sensitive to the fact men ran the world. You have wonderful Queen Esthers. You have wonderful queens throughout. The first witnesses to Jesus' resurrection are women, and they're all over the place. But in general, man ran the show. And it wasn't really until you have modern birth control, women's freedom to be out after a couple of years of childbearing, out in the larger world again, that we suddenly ask, well, how is this going on? But I think sometimes we translate this strangely when we think that He means penis and testicles, and that's what a male is. I had a colleague, the late colleague, a Jewish scholar, Tikva Frymer-Kinsky, who wrote a book on After the Goddesses, on how Israel talks about God. And she said, you can't think of a being without anthropomorphism. That is, in the Hebrew scriptures, God has a holy arm. God has a face lifted up upon you. She said the one thing that the Hebrew scriptures are not a bit interested in is God below the waistline. And I think if you remember that way, he meant generically human being. Mm-hmm. And yes, God was potentate. There are many images, though, in the Bible that are being cultivated today, not only by women in the church, but commentators of all sorts. God says, I gave birth to you, O Israel. I nursed you, O Israel. I took you by the hand. All these images that guys can't do are present. The figure of wisdom in the book of Proverbs is a she. It's not God, but it's a voice of God. But your question has right the point. You start with the assumption that normally scriptures talked about male deities.
And certainly I think the caller is pointing to, at least I think he would say that by and large churches have been rather patriarchal operations. Do you think that that is something that is changing or has changed?
Well, I think in general it's changed. You have a couple huge bodies, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, Southern Baptists, and so on, who don't ordain women, and therefore we think they're more patriarchal. And yet the Catholics have had the largest woman workforce in the sisters for years. Yes, they get, you know, Rome is now investigating religious orders of women. Guys over there are deciding that one again. But it's very widespread. And if you go to any seminary of mainline and more evangelical, huge numbers of women are heading toward ordination. And the more of them there are, the less patriarchalism you're going to get away with. But I've overstressed the clergy side. The place to look for it is in all the retreats, the classes, the books. At the Christian Century, where I used to edit, where I write, if we were going to get a big readership, we publish things by Kathleen Norris and Barbara Brown Taylor and any number of the spiritual writers are women. And all of them are subverting patriarchy without always making it a protest march.
Well, we suddenly have some callers, and we only have about 5 minutes, so we'll see how many we can get. They're all in Champaign. We'll start. We'll take them in the order they came in, and what means we'll start with line one. Right here. Hello.
I am curious about your views on the segregation of the church, even as we have more institutions become greater integration and more choice of styles that don't reflect a race segregation, yet our church continues to be segregated.
I'm working right now with some people who are making a film on just this question, and they're featuring the late Howard Thurman, who had a church for all nations. And the more you get into it, you find that, in general, prejudice has gone down, tolerance has gone up. We're still adapted, though, to, first of all, places of residence. There's a Latino part of town, and there's an African-American part of town and a white part of town, Those barriers are slow to change, and with that often come worship styles. They don't naturally and easily come together. So let's say the ideology has changed, the practice is slow, it's got to do better.
Right. And to another caller, I want to thank that caller, and let's go to line number two. This is also Champagne. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Perhaps you'll be addressing this question this evening in your talk, but I was wondering, who would Jesus bomb, and who would Jesus interrogate in an enhanced way? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, Jesus interrogated everybody in an enhanced way, but a nonviolent way. That is, he got right to the heart of things, and he knew what was keeping you from the way of God. But I know what you mean by interrogation, and that doesn't fit anywhere in Jesus' pattern. Every trace we get in the Gospels of Jesus is nonviolent, very clearly so. He didn't believe that the kingdom of God had to be wielded with the earthly power. Some of his disciples carried swords, and he wanted them put away. It's a world where everybody carried them and weren't supposed to use them. So the image of Jesus as an agent of peacemaking, I think, is a very clear one.
And to line number three, this is also Champagne. Hello.
Hello. This is a much more specific kind of question, and I just am looking for a little broader view. My family grew up in the Congregational Church, and I've noticed in the last probably 20, 25 years, there seems to be a little bit of a split with the UCC broadly. Some of the churches more traditional, some more open and affirming. In most cases, we've noticed female ministers in the more open and affirming churches. And when my folks came to town, they said, well, do you know if this is a lesbian situation? I thought, I have no idea. Is this something that is affecting a large number of churches or this denomination only? I'm just going to hang up and listen because my information is slight.
Okay, and my time is short, but I'll try to do my best with it. United Church of Christ is the first of the large denominations to ordain gays and lesbians. They've been all over the place. There are a lot of putatively non-practicing ones in almost every denomination. But they were the leaders in that. The Congregational is really two factions, one blended in with another group, Evangelical Reformed, to form United Church of Christ. And they are very open and affirming. Some of the independent Congregationalists didn't go along with that, and they may be back. In Congregationalism, you could be all kinds of all over the place. Episcopalianism is there. I'm a member of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which recently voted to change its access to ministry. But I think the way they put the question is a strange one. I am often at churches where there is an open acceptance of lesbians, and you would never think of it being a lesbian church. One of them in which my own pastor's daughter was president of the congregation and was lesbian in a committed relationship. She'd been president of it, and they asked if I'd preach there. I didn't see any more lesbians and gays there than I saw anywhere else, but I saw all kinds of people from the neighborhood who knew they meant they're all welcome. And it's often a symbol of that kind of openness. There's a downside. People who don't like this retreat and form their own groups. But the United Church of Christ and Congregationalism has been the avant-garde of this.
I'll ask you a question that I can't possibly give you enough time to answer. It's something we could, I'm sure, talk for a long time about. But it is something that we have seen in with church people, religious activists, say religious activists in the 19th century, maybe in the early 20th century, seemed much more interested in pursuing issues of social justice, or at least looking at those things that affected the society as a whole. And it seems now for many people who are religious activists, the focus has changed to things that one might call matters of individual behavior, what people do in their own lives, sometimes behind closed doors in their own homes. Why do you think that change occurred?
Well, I think if you read the whole history of the 19th century, the church has tried to specialize in private vice and private virtue. They had huge agencies against dueling, profanity, carrying the mails on Sunday, etc. It took a long time for them to get up the energy to begin to oppose slavery in the northern churches and so on, etc. And it's the late 19th century when the great surge came that you look at other situations. And Catholicism entered in 1919 when suddenly you have an agency that says people are the 40-hour week and against child labor and so on. But I think what we're seeing today is that so many of the private scenes are connected to a larger public order that you can't just say, for one thing, you wonder why they specialize in bedroom issues and bathroom issues and private affairs. They see them connected to a larger way of life that they think is subverting the larger society. I think they're wrong, but I think that explains it.
We have just recently elected the first person of color president of the United States. I'm sure that there are many people who also will be waiting for the day when we have our first woman president. Do you think that an avowed atheist could be elected president of the United States?
Couldn't be right now. There's no reason not to be, but couldn't be. Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution says there dare be no religious tests for any public office. And it's societal way of doing this, of discriminating, and it's probably the last great discrimination. You're going to have almost anybody else before that. You will have great numbers of people who may not believe in God, but don't make a crusade out of it. But that's one of the American taboos. When you do that, then people back off.
Well, I'm sure we could keep talking for a long time, but we must stop here because we've come to the end of the time. But certainly I want to make sure that people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana know that our guest, Dr. Martin Marty, will be speaking tonight at the 2009 Wesley Fall Seminar. That's at 7 o'clock at the Wesley Church and Student Foundation. That's at the corner of Green and Goodwin on the U of I campus. He'll be speaking on the topic Religion, Violence, and the Global Searches for Peace. There'll also be a reception afterwards given by the Wesley United Methodist Women, and the public is invited to both the lecture and reception. So if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Dr. Martin Marty, you are welcome to attend. And, of course, you're interested in reading some of his thoughts about religion, you just head down to the library or the bookstore and you look for some of his work. He has written over 50 books on a range of religious subjects. He is an emeritus professor of the history of Christianity at University of Chicago. Thanks very much.
Great to be with you.